Now, let's talk about changing the way doctors are trained. When I am asked how I would change medical education, I think of a wonderful painting called The Doctor, now in the Tate Gallery in London. Stop for a minute. Think about it. If I asked you to do a painting called The Doctor, what would you portray? There are many paintings by that name, and they illustrate different scenes. The one I am thinking of shows a man sitting in a cabin, leaning over the bed of a sick child. He is not surrounded by fancy equipment. He is just listening and caring, while the concerned parents are in the background. The artist, Sir Luke Vildes, painted the picture in 1891. He had the experience of having one of his children die on Christmas Day. He knows what the doctor means to him. Today, if I said to a group of doctors, please paint a picture called The Doctor, it might just be filled with instruments and white coats. When I show a slide of this painting, I ask people to tell me if it is called Too Late or The Doctor. People can feel the care in the painting, and they call it The Doctor. I want physicians to understand that it is never too late, that there is always someone in need of healing. We must remember that the word doctor has as its root meaning to teach. Over my desk at home and in the office, I hung copies of the Vildes painting to remind myself about the kind of physician I wanted to be, that it was never too late to teach and to heal. Certainly, doctors and nurses do not set out to build walls around themselves or to be villains. If you go to a medical school graduation, you don't get mad at the hundreds of young men and women who are graduating and looking forward to helping people. The problem is what happens to them in their training and in the ensuing years. The pain of life and the pain of the people they're caring for begins to affect them more and more, and they stop feeling because they have no guidance. Medical schools need to teach doctors that it is important to express feelings and to share the difficulties of being a doctor through meetings and classes in which they can talk to one another about their pain. I think it is our training that is villainous. Even when medical students go into training, they are not given the support and education they need to keep from depersonalizing people. Some of that is obviously due to the people teaching them who haven't themselves dealt with those issues. But unless we empower the students and the patients to speak up and demand what is needed, change is going to be slow. What the present system will create is a group of people who might have been excellent physicians, who no longer choose to be physicians, or who may have to be very careful in the specialties they select so they can protect themselves. Most physicians would not be physicians again, and others are becoming so specialized that medical care will be adversely affected. Certain specialties remove you from caring for truly sick people who might threaten you or make you feel inadequate. There are a lot of ways in which I would like to humanize medical education. I would insist that doctors experience what it is like to be ill themselves. I'd like to see each doctor put into a hospital where he or she is not known with a diagnosis of a life-threatening illness. He or she would stay there for a week and see how they are treated. I would like the doctor to be treated in a way that will lead him to be a native, so that he will be able to say to a patient, I have some understanding of what you're going through. I have experienced this too. Patients would become part of the training process. Physicians would learn that they are treating people, not only diseases, and that people are different from textbook cases. I'd introduce them to people during the first week of medical school, not just to a textbook or a dead body, but to a living human being. I'd encourage patients to say, here I am, and I want you to know what it's like to be sick. I want you to know why you're studying all this. Medical students and doctors who have had cancer, AIDS, and other life-threatening illnesses should speak to future doctors. Doctors should hear about dreams and drawings, about the work of Carl Jung and others, all of which tap into the knowledge of patients. I'd have 90-year-olds give lectures so that doctors can better understand the experience of living. Doctors should attend sessions at shrines such as Lourdes, where incurables come, so that they will understand the value of hope and a prayer. I see changes today that make me feel hopeful. As I look back at brochures from the American Cancer Society from the 1980s, they were talking about cancer, not people. They were telling people not to rely on self-induced healing, as it was unproven scientifically. But self-induced healing is the only kind of healing there is. I wrote to the American College of Surgeons about their pledge, which includes the words, "I will deal with my patients as I would wish to be dealt with if I were in the patient's position. I don't want to be dealt with. I want to be cared for." I may add that they responded to my letter and have invited me to write an article. I am disappointed, however, to say that originally it was scheduled for October, which then became January, which became February, and still hasn't been printed. I think they are frightened about the content of my article, entitled Surgery, Mechanical, or Healing Art. The American Cancer Society is also beginning to do the kinds of psychosocial training for doctors and nurses that they were looking down upon years ago. I do think that doctors are becoming more open to many of these ideas now. I get more and more calls from medical schools, hospitals, and medical organizations asking me to come and speak. Doctors who 10 or 15 years ago wondered why I was invited to come to their institutions are now the ones introducing me. They are becoming more open because they are beginning to understand their own pain and that of their patients. Originally, medical care incorporated three entities: preaching, teaching, and healing. When I say preaching, I mean that doctors help people find their inner strength and spirituality. They help heal lives, and they cure diseases as well. Along the way, preachers have taken over one role, teachers another, and doctors have become mechanics. I think we need to bring all of these professions together. Dr. Deepak Chopra, physician and author, discusses in his book, The Return of the Rishi, The Doctor's Search for the Ultimate Healing, being called when he was an intern to see a man who had died. He had to pronounce the man dead and share that with the family. He said, "My first American patient had been a dead man. It wasn't as I had expected. Everything had been medically proper, yet so unhealthy. The machines were in the room, and the family was outside the door. That seemed peculiar to me. In India, the family is in the room, and the machines are nowhere." Dr. Chopra discusses his reaction to a patient. "We were bound by emotions that lie beyond personality. We were bound by love. A patient occupies a privileged position in my life that nothing else can explain. Profound feelings occur," he says, "only when the physician is totally willing to accept his responsibility. If there is a fear of disease, any rejection of the patient, or any clinging to authority, then conventional medicine cannot become what should be an art. It remains a common trade. I began to realize years ago that our greatest resource is the people we take care of. Please, doctors, be open to your patients. Be there when a patient dies. Be with families. Let them sustain you. Deliver eulogies at funerals. I have done this because people have asked me to share their lives, to tell stories about life. This has made me confront my own mortality, my own death. And then I had the courage to be present and to share my vulnerability. That's what I would say to every physician. Deal with your mortality, your death, your humanity, and it will help you become a true healer." We can also be our own teachers. We don't have to learn only from others. There are times we can pick up our own torch, and as we light our way, we also light the path for others, doctors as well as patients. I want to share the pain of a conscientious physician who wrote me to say, "I missed a diagnosis, and it appears the patient is going to die. I have given myself the flu to take time out to deal with my feelings." This is a doctor who has been in practice for many years and missed diagnosing a carcinoma of the colon, even though her initial workup was quite proper and all the tests were done. And so the symptoms were considered to be due to irritable bowel until later tests showed metastatic cancer in the liver. She continued, "I'm partly afraid to go back to work, which I must do tomorrow, for fear of hurting someone else by errors of omission. I'm more aware than ever of the huge responsibility of being a physician, and suddenly not sure I want it. My questions are, how does one live with mistakes that cost people their lives? How do you personally deal with the responsibility of being a doctor? How do I forgive myself and carry on?" I think that in a sense, this entire tape is an answer to her. but I also know that one must see one's humanity and fallibility not as a sign of failure, but simply as a sign of being human. Obviously, I think each physician should be a good mechanic and know his subject and material, but we are human, and we also need to forgive ourselves when we are not perfect. Most of all, I'd say that healing needs to go on between the patient and the physician. We forgive each other when we admit our humanity, but we don't forgive each other when we try to play God and feel that we should be perfect. A doctor asked, "How do you deal with grief as a professional, remain effective and helpful to your patients and their families without feeling torn up? How do you survive being a doctor with all of the pain, responsibility, and guilt?" The answer, again, is with difficulty. You feel pain when beautiful people die. You feel torn apart in the operating room when you can't cure cancer, when you can't remove it. Through it all, you begin to awaken to a realization that you have something more to offer people. You can stay with them, hold their hand. You can help them to live during the time that they have. Giving support, love, and caring, not deserting someone, that's what gets you through. And you get back an enormous gift. The love of many incredibly courageous people who teach you to stop fearing and to stop being angry and resenting and to simply know that difficulties are inherent in life. Robert E. Murphy, a third-year student, wrote an essay called First Day about his first experience in the coronary care unit. It was horrendous. He said he felt more and more stupid as the day wore on. He was not able to answer questions. They weren't multiple choice. The nurses were constantly after him. He didn't find time for lunch. And finally he wrote, "I was told to stick Mr. Hunt for cardiac enzymes. I had only drawn blood on three classmates, and I missed one of those." Notice that he sticks Mr. Hunt, but draws blood on classmates. Even this sensitive third-year medical student is depersonalizing the patient already. I palpated a nice vein in his left arm and was ready to stick him when he said, "You know, I don't think you're supposed to draw that above the IV." Even the patients knew more than I did. But because of his difficulties, attempting to draw the blood three times and being unsuccessful, he and Mr. Hunt had a chance to talk, and he explained to Mr. Hunt all of the reasons he was in the hospital and the nature of the tests they were doing. And in the end, due to the trouble he was having, he said, "I'll get the intern." Mr. Hunt said, "No, give it another shot. I know you can do it." And he did. When he was about to leave, Mr. Hunt commented, "You're one of those student doctors, aren't you?" He nodded and confessed that Mr. Hunt was his first patient. Mr. Hunt said, "Nobody has sat down and said a word to me for 2 days. I know you're real smart and you're a mighty nice fella. You're going to be a good doctor, I can tell." And he finished the essay by saying, "It was a very good first day." I realized in the same way in my own practice that I could say to patients, "I'm having a lousy day." And that included patients lying in intensive care unit on respirators. I remember with great emotion going to see a woman in her 20s. She was a nurse with extensive cancer, which had spread to her lungs. The only way she could breathe was with the help of a respirator. I went because the family wanted me to help her. I didn't know what I could offer her. And when I walked into the room and she saw me, she sat up, put her arms out, and embraced me. She really took care of me. From then on, I had no fear of ever visiting anyone again because I knew we could give to each other and we could hurt and suffer together. Hope is a wonderful resource for the physician, even when things seem hopeless. To give a family hope is never wrong. I am not talking about lying, but about hope. None of us know the future. There are many people I know who were not given hope, who are alive and well today because they had the strength to reach out, grasp it, and go on. One man wrote to me about this. "I talked with you a little at your workshop. I was the one diagnosed 5 years ago with full-blown AIDS. I wanted to share some good news. About 2 months ago, I went to my doctors to ask if they would give me the AIDS antigen test. They were reluctant and questioned the point of doing that. I told them I knew what the result would be and asked them to humor me. I finally got them to do it, and the last test came back negative. No evidence of viral activity. This was a wonderful confirmation for me of what you, Louise Hay, and others have been saying all along. The power of faith and conviction in knowing what is true for oneself, regardless of what everyone else is telling you, can indeed work miracles of healing. Thank you for your message of hope. A doctor once said about me, he's telling people what they want to hear. I've also had the criticism that I give false hope. But there is no false hope. False hope tends to be a recital of statistics, and people are not statistics. But there is false no hope. I don't think that the gentleman who had AIDS, even if he hadn't gotten well, would be writing to say, oh, you upset me by telling me what I wanted to hear. That's an absurdity. I am not telling lies. I am telling truths. I am not denying the seriousness of many, many diseases. I expect to die someday, despite writing these books. What I am talking about is human potential and what may happen. And I can share that with people honestly and openly. It does not mean telling them what they want to hear. It means telling them that they have a chance to fight for their lives, that they're not sentenced to death. Some people want to hear it. Some don't want to take up the struggle. But to those who do want to fight for their lives, yes, it's what they want to hear, that there is a chance. There is for everybody. Doctors know that, but they get caught up in the mechanistic statistical view of the world and stop seeing people. I see people because I talk to them, I read my mail, I meet people, and I know how wonderful they are and what they're capable of. Hope isn't statistical, and individuals recover. There will always be a first person to recover from every disease. Nobody gets angry at being given hope. I have never received a letter saying, you made me laugh and gave me hope, but I'm going to die anyway, so I'm mad at you. I am stopped in hallways, airports, everywhere, by people who say, thank you. They will say, my loved one died, but I want to thank you for what you brought into our lives. I want to talk for a while about spirituality, religion, and healing. I was brought up in the Jewish tradition and grew up believing that God restores us and sustains us. God is a resource. If I lose my health, then God is there to assist me in restoring my health and supporting me in finding what I have lost. I know that God has given us self-induced healing abilities and is a loving, creative, intelligent energy. I see this in the simplest things. I see it when a wound heals. Where does that wonderful ability come from? If that self-healing potential weren't there, each of us would bleed to death or die of an infection from every cut or scratch. So I know my body loves me. I listened to a physicist discuss the expansion of the universe. He says that if the rate of expansion were changed by a trillion trillionth, the universe would not exist. And I begin to think, what or who is behind all this? It can't be an accident. I don't mean who in the sense of some wise old man or woman sitting up in heaven keeping track of everything, but this incredible awareness and intelligence that exists in life, in nature, in us. It is being a scientist that makes me spiritual. I can't accept all of this as coincidence. I like to make a distinction between the words religion and spiritual. In our culture, for many of the people I see, religion can be a destructive force. In some cases, religion seems to be teaching people they deserve to suffer. They are sinners, and disease is an appropriate punishment. But I cannot accept this. Those are man-made rules. If one accepts the messages of spirituality and love, grace is available to us all. It is what all religions are based upon, though the man-made rules have altered them. Religion can support you and, in a sense, hold you in the palm of its hand, or it can grasp and possess you. Too often, I think, we are possessed by it. Spirituality is a healing force and a support. With spirituality, there are no rules related to God's love and God's ability to sustain us. When someone asks, what do you think is the meaning of life? I might answer, life is an experience and an opportunity. The meaning comes from what we decide to do with the opportunity and experience that is given to us. I think we are, very simply, meant to love, and what we each need to do is to choose our way of loving the world. Then when you get up on Monday morning, you don't have to have your heart attack, because you're choosing your own path. You are looking forward to Monday morning and your way of contributing to the world. And for those who didn't know it, the most frequent hour of the day to have a heart attack is Monday morning, about 9 a.m. To me, the Garden of Eden represents the place where love must exist. But that would become boring. Just picture us saying, I love you, to each other all day long, everybody you met on the street. But once we are out of the garden into a place where love is a choice, then it really becomes meaningful. I think we are here to try to reflect back the love that created the universe and to make this planet a place where children are loved and where pollution and self-destruction end, because we love ourselves and therefore can spread that love. The purpose of our being here is to love, but it has to come freely, not as a burden. If we do this, we receive a gift. Nature can be our teacher. I learn more by looking at nature than at anything else. And so when you have a problem, I'd suggest you go out and talk to a tree or a stream or look at the ocean and think, what would nature do if it had your problem? You will always get an answer. Nature knows how to deal with adversity, chaos, and difficulties, and how to continue just as we do. One day, when I was out in the woods near our house, walking our cat Miracle, who thinks she's a dog, I found myself talking to a tree about a problem. Then I walked around the tree and received my answer. Years earlier, I had nailed part of a wire fence to that tree. Now I noticed that the tree had grown around the fence. It had just incorporated the fence into its trunk. So the tree told me what to do. When something is irritating me, in my way, I can grow around it and take it in. I often discuss what I feel is the symbolism of the leaves changing in the fall, that before you let go of the tree of life, you show your uniqueness, individuality, and beauty. Green is a cover-up. God is reminding us of the importance of our differences. They are what make us beautiful, not just another green leaf on the family tree. I hope we can learn to see the world and each other in the way of the Native American Iroquois, who, when they are making decisions, think in terms of 7 generations into the future. That vision should be incorporated into our lives, too. On simpler terms, I heard Alice Walker, the author, say that when you make a decision, think, is this good for the children? Dr. Rachel Naomi Remen, a friend and physician, has experienced illness and surgery in her life. So she is a native in the world of the doctor and of the patient. And she says, the purpose of life is to grow in wisdom and to learn to love better. If life serves these purposes, then health serves these purposes and illness serves them as well, because illness is part of life. The Dalai Lama said, the purpose of life is to serve other people, to do something of benefit for other people. From that point of view, a difficulty is really a great opportunity. Even the Bible tells us that the Son of Man comes not to be served, but to serve, and to ransom his life for the good of the many. And understand that this is done out of love. It is not a burden. A friend of mine said, when his lover died of AIDS, the purpose of life is the growth of the soul. The body is not the measure of healing. Peace is the measure. And part of the healing is to accept and embrace death. People with AIDS or life-threatening diseases must come to terms with death. The more one resists it or denies it, the more power it has. It is the quality of life that is the real issue, whether you live for 6 days or 60 years. Self-love is at the core of all healing, allowing ourselves to live powerfully from the truth of our being. I really would ask all of you to stop the tape, go back, and listen to the last few minutes again. You have just heard what life is about. I could go on for another hour with quotes that are similar. Listen. If you ask, I can choose to live or I can choose to die. I need something to live for. How do I find it? I say, look around. If there is something else alive in your view when you raise your eyes, that is a reason to live. Fill your house with plants. Who's going to take care of them if you die? Get a cat. I know a woman who had a dozen cats. She couldn't die because she needed to take care of them. Find someone who has more difficulties than you have. Look around you on the street. There are homeless people, drug addicts, young people who have lost their way. Get out there and do something for someone else who is in pain. Out of your pain, you will find that you have a reason to live. Get someone else to smile. I once called life a beautiful burden, and someone got mad at me for calling it a burden. But I think it is like an enormous gift that is handed to you that may be hard to carry, and you may need some help carrying it. Life is God's gift to us. What we do with it is our gift to God. One of the questions I was shocked to hear people ask years ago was, how do you know God doesn't want me to have cancer? Maybe God is punishing me with my disease. Today, I am not surprised because I understand better the source of the guilt and shame. Disease isn't punishment. It is a part of life. If you are going to accept the gift of life, you're going to accept its difficulties. Everyone must die, and you are not a sinner if you have an affliction. It doesn't mean you didn't love enough or that you did something wrong. It is simply part of what life is about. In 1829, Pope Leo XII declared that whoever allowed himself to be vaccinated against smallpox ceased to be a child of God. That smallpox was a judgment of God and the vaccination a challenge toward heaven. Of course, this is no longer believed, but there can remain a subtle conscious and unconscious effect on people. I believe we should understand that God didn't create the world to make people suffer. But I also believe that God knew we needed the freedom to experience all things in order to make life meaningful. I think the ideal approach to illness, and life for that matter, lies in the Serenity Prayer composed by Reinhold Niebuhr. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So, if you are patient, there are some things you leave to God, which may include your schedule. There are some things you fight to change, being treated like a human being in a hospital and not being called room 510 or the lymphoma. You learn what to allow, what to surrender to, and what to make the difference in. If you consider Helen Keller, who became deaf and blind at 19 months, you might think here was somebody whose parents should have been devastated, who should have wondered, what did we do wrong? Why is God punishing us? But if you listen to her words, you will know that she never saw her afflictions as a punishment. She confronted them as something to be overcome. I think that challenge came out of the fact that her parents were involved not in issues of guilt, but with the question, what can we do for this child? Remember, this is someone who became blind and deaf at the age of 19 months and ultimately graduated from college. Listen to what she says in her book, My Religion. I have never believed that my limitations were in any sense punishments or accidents. If I had held such a view, I could never have exerted the strength to overcome them. Difficulties meet us at every turn. They are the accompaniment of life. Out of pain grow the violets of patience and sweetness. The marvelous richness of human experience would lose something of rewarding joy if there were no limitations to overcome. Now, I must say, I know a lot of people who might read that and get angry at Helen Keller. But for me, she speaks the truth. Faith in God can help us heal. Some people believe that this is enough, and they wonder, why do I need surgery? I think God and our capabilities are quite powerful, but we are fallible. We are human. We can't always achieve everything we want to, and I believe in bringing in other resources. I do know people who have said, I left my troubles to God, and their cancer has gone away with the peace that that brought them. If you think you're capable of doing that, fine. I also know that if you read the Bible, you will find that the physician is a resource, a gift from God. All medications stem from God. They're all, in a sense, natural, and so we can accept all things. Surgery, radiation, chemotherapy can all be gifts from God. And when I see people doing drawings showing that treatment is a gift, or the operating room is a place where love and God exist, I know that they can incorporate their treatment into their lives. It becomes a part of God manifesting himself or herself. You're being held in the hand. I often refer to God as female because I think our female qualities are related to healing and problem solving. All things become manifestations of God in a sense, including the surgeon and the therapy. They're all part of the same system, the same creation. I'm sure that someday we will find through research, some of which has already been done, that our consciousness, our prayers, our thoughts can affect us and others, that there is an energy available to all of us that can be used for healing. You can label this God if you want to, but we are God also. We are part of this wonderful universal system. We are co-creators. While some people believe that everything should be left to God, others have asked, why does God have to play such a grand role in your philosophy? Don't you think that psychoneuroimmunology accounts for much of the explained so-called miracles? Isn't all healing scientific? To me, God is psychoneuroimmunology. My definition of God is intelligent, loving energy. God is scientific. God is light. God is darkness. God is all. Please do not write to me to debate this. As Bobby says, an atheist is a person with no invisible means of support. This is my belief, my sense. Religion and science can come together. The truth is they probably are the same thing, just as mind and body are. Certainly spirituality and science can come together. If you think of creativity and spirituality, think of things that Einstein and other quantum physicists have said. They have seen the universe as incredible, awe-inspiring. They had a sense of the unity of the world and all the entities within it and the many mysteries that kept them open-minded. I sometimes ask people if they think life is fair. I ask them to shout out the answer yes or no, and the majority always answer no. But my feeling is that life is absolutely fair. It's just that we need to redefine the rules. Difficulties, problems, pain, and losses come with life. And so our question becomes, how do we deal with those things? Can we use them as redirections and even look at them as gifts? That's really what this book is about. Because once you learn to live with difficulties, life seems easier. I learned many years ago that when I meet a genuinely happy person, it is not because they have had only good fortune. I know they are choosing their attitude. At the hospital, I used to give out pins to all the people I saw bringing love and happiness to those around them. I'd walk up to them and say, I'd like to know your name. And sure, most of them thought, well, this is a doctor. He wants my name because I'm doing something wrong. He'll report me. So they would just say their name. And then I would use their name to make up a lovely pin with a rainbow and their name on it. And a month later, when it was made, I'd bring them the pin and give it to them as a gift. Eventually, in that way, we created a subversive organization of lovers in the hospital who were identifiable to each other. One day, I went up to a medical secretary who was always surrounded by happy people. I said, I'd like to know your name. She said, why? I said, because I want to give you a gift. You create this aura of happiness around you, and I want to thank you for it. And she replied, sit down. I have a story to tell you. I've been here 2 years. When I took the job, I signed a contract, came to work, and was immediately surrounded by miserable people. I mean the doctors and nurses. The patients weren't a problem. So I went down to the office at lunchtime and said, I refuse this job. I quit. And they said, you can't quit. You've signed a contract. You have to give us 2 weeks' notice. I said, all right, I'm giving you 2 weeks' notice. I got up every day after that unhappy until the last day of the 2 weeks. Then I got up so happy. It was my last day, and I went to work happy. I realized something at the end of the day. All the people around me were happy, so I didn't quit. I just decided to come in happy. And that is the choice each of us is capable of making. We must realize that the joy and light are created within us. They don't come from outside. I may add that when I talked about life as a labor pain, I could say to you also, life is a prison sentence. So remember to learn from the people you meet who are imprisoned in bodies or incarcerated in institutions who are still happy human beings. As one man said, I used to get up every day condemned to die. Now I get up to live. He said, I'm still using a sledgehammer to break up pieces of concrete, but I live every day now. Today, when I meet people who make a difference in my life, I have a new pin. It says on it, you make a difference, and I give it to them. And I also share with them that if they meet someone who makes a difference in their life, to pass the gift on. We are interdependent, and someday I know someone will walk up to me and give me one of my pins back. One solution to the feeling that life is unfair would be to live life backwards. I have suggested this to the board of directors of heaven. We could die first, get it out of the way, and then we could grow younger. And I have given them this poem. Let me share it with you. Life is tough. It takes up a lot of your time and all your weekends. And what do you get at the end of it? Death, great reward. I think that the life cycle is all backwards. You should die first, get it out of the way. Then you live 20 years in an old age home. You get kicked out when you're too young. You get a gold watch and you go to work. You work 40 years until you're young enough to enjoy your retirement. Then you go to college and you party until you're ready for high school. Then you become a little kid and you play. You have no responsibilities. You become a little boy or girl. You go back into the womb. You spend your last 9 months floating. And you finish off as a gleam in someone's eye. As I have just mentioned to you, I am familiar with the Board of Directors of Heaven. I like to add jokingly that I have served as an outside advisor on the Board of Directors of Heaven, and that each year God selects 3 men and 3 women to help her keep up to date on current topics, and that God gives each of us a plaque at the end of our term that says, don't feel totally, personally, irrevocably, eternally responsible for everything. That's my job, and it's signed God. I think that message ought to make us all feel better and lighten our burdens. The only thing that is going to save people and save the world is if we forgive and love each other, and then healing can come. God isn't the problem. It doesn't mean that I have to like everything that you have done, but not to forgive means that there are things that I can't forgive myself for either. In the Bible, we are told that Jesus said to a man who was paralyzed, "Your sins are forgiven." Jesus knew that the important point was to heal your life, because a life can be healed even without a cured disease. God doesn't have problems forgiving. As a matter of fact, she said, that's her job. We are the problem. The author Joseph Heller wrote a book called No Laughing Matter about his experience with paralysis due to an infectious disease of his nervous system. He told about the visits of many of his friends, including Mel Brooks, who came into his room and said, in the name of Jesus, stand and walk. Heller looked up and said, it didn't work. And Mel Brooks said, well, it was worth a try. I wrote to Mel Brooks to tell him, next time you visit a friend, say, your sins are forgiven, and maybe it will help. I know how much we need forgiveness for our acts in order to begin to live or die peacefully. I have literally walked through a nursing home saying, your sins are forgiven, and people get very quiet when they hear this. A man who has had a near-death experience has devoted his life to care of the aging and ill. He wrote to me after I had talked about how healing this statement is. He told me that in the early 1980s, he worked a 3-to-11 shift as a nurse's aide in a nursing home, giving primary care to residents who seemed to be waiting to die. It was his habit to say goodnight to some of the patients who insisted that he not leave before doing so. One woman, Mrs. D, became very close to him and often questioned him about his belief in forgiveness. She had been unable to walk for 6 years. She waited every night for him to tuck her in and kiss her goodnight before she would go to sleep. They had many talks about God, death, and family. He wrote, "One evening, as I headed out the door toward my car, feeling exhausted and grateful that the evening's work was over, I heard a high-pitched, mournful cry from the window overlooking the parking lot. It stopped me in my tracks. I realized I had failed to say goodnight to Mrs. D and put her to bed. I returned to her room and found her sitting upright in her bed looking anguished and upset. She scolded me and then asked me to sit down. As we talked, I realized she wanted to discuss matters of great importance to her. She asked, 'Do you think God will forgive anything?' I had spoken to her and others of my near-death experience and my absolute knowing that God is all-loving and all-forgiving. I recognized that she was holding a great sense of shame and guilt, so I reassured her that there was nothing she could have done that would prevent her from receiving God's love and grace. She told me, 'When I was a young woman, I stole my parents' fine silver so my fiancé and I could elope. I never talked to them again. I feel so bad and ashamed. I've never told this to anyone, and I am afraid to die.' I leaned close to her and said, 'I know that God forgives you. God knows you and only wants you to know his love.' I put her to bed and left. The next morning, when I came in, the administrator and the nursing director were waiting for me. They asked, 'What did you say to Mrs. D last night?' I said that we talked about love and forgiveness. 'Why?' 'Last night, at about 2 a.m., Mrs. D walked unassisted all the way down the hall from her room to the nurse's station, put her Bible and her teeth on the counter, and said, "I won't be needing these anymore. Thank you." She walked unassisted back to her bed, lay down, and died. She died with peace of mind. Obviously, the forgiveness helped heal her life. I hope we will all be able to forgive ourselves, because God certainly has. I mean, forgive ourselves so that we can live fully, accepting every part of ourselves, not just be forgiven so we can end our lives, but be forgiven so that we can begin them. To forgive ourselves, we have to accept our shadow. According to Carl Jung, the shadow stands for the dark, unexplored part of ourselves, the part we often project onto someone or something else if we don't explore and accept it. He illustrated this in a colorful way. If God is at the front door, the devil will be at the back door. I understand that within me lies a potential murderer, and once I know that, I don't become a murderer. I can deal with that part of myself. It is conscious now. Accepting my own shadow makes it easier to accept someone else's. We have to understand that there is a big difference between loving and liking. I'm not asking people to like what a criminal has done, but if you know that you yourself could be a criminal, it will be easier to understand the criminal and what created the criminal. And love can lead to rehabilitation and healing, not just punishment and incarceration. Now let's talk about facing death. People sometimes ask how they can face the death issue. I think this means accepting the fact that we are mortal. We all have a limited amount of time here, whether it is one day or 20 or 60 years. Live the day or the years. That is the key. One woman said, "I have cancer, but I am still a young person with children to raise. I don't feel ready to face death at all." You have children to raise. What is it that you want your children to know? If you weren't here, what would they have? They would have the memory of your voice, telling them that you love and accept them no matter what. Put it on tape. Let them have it. But maybe you also want to give them letters or the tapes, just reminding them that you love them and that when difficulties come, God is redirecting them, so they can grow up with messages from their mother that are going to stay with them no matter what happens to you. That's how you become immortal. What would you want to leave behind? What would you want to share with them? What would you want to teach them? I think that if they know they are loved and that difficulties lie ahead, but that life is about what we can contribute, they will make it through. I'd say to you and to everyone, if you need to, make out a will. Do it. Get it off your mind. Are there treasures you want people to have? Write out anything that you feel people need to know. But remember, as the lady said after doing all those things she loved, now I'm so busy, I'm killing myself. It's quite possible that when you do all the things you want to do before you die, you may feel too good to die. One way I evaluate hospices is to ask if they have graduation ceremonies, because people can heal their lives in preparation for dying and then feel better and so get sent home. Start now to do some of the things you have always wanted to do. If you have always wished for a pet, if you have wanted to plant a garden, study a language, go camping, whatever it is, do it so that you are living to the fullest now, living short time segments to make them meaningful. All the clocks in heaven have their hands broken off and say, 1, 2, 3, 4, who cares, on their face. I suggest to everyone, go to the hardware store and buy the letters with sticky backs that say, who cares, and put them on your clock. It will cover all the numbers except 1, 2, 3, 4. I think that is the way to face the death issue. Not that you become depressed about the fact that you could die of cancer or AIDS or heart disease, but you accept the fact that death is an event we all must confront. Denying it will not help. What do you have to do to get ready? What do you need to do to complete your life? Sadness and grief I can understand because of separation from your family. But then I would ask, what is there about death that frightens you? What are the things you need to confront? Talk about your fears so that you are in charge of your death, and maybe even the details of your funeral. What music do you want to have played? I have a long list made out. What do you want it to be like? This may seem morbid, but I'd rather deal with those issues and not make them significant events that wear me out. At one of our workshops in Chicago, a beautiful lady in her 80s said that when she learned she had cancer, she called all her children together and her husband, who was a retired surgeon, and they discussed her funeral, the music, the caterer, all the details. Her children were upset by the conversation, but she sat them down and they went through the plans together. And of course she didn't die, but all the plans have been made. When my father and his brother were younger and were helping care for the family cemetery plot, they would actually lie down on the places that were meant to be their future burial sites and decide which exposure they wanted, which one would give them the most sun. Why is that meaningful? Because they were confronting their mortality. But the beautiful and even humorous thing was that when it came time to put my father's coffin into the grave, the men doing it picked up the coffin and turned it around for no apparent reason and placed it in just the position my dad had decided upon. That brought a smile to all of our lips. He lived fully until he died and then made sure that his instructions were followed. I'd ask you to do that so that your children don't grow up afraid of the same things that you are afraid of, but are stronger individuals because of you. There is a special person whose words I would like to share with you. She had been a wonderful athlete, but then she was diagnosed with cancer. It involved her central nervous system and lungs. On several occasions, she went through operations, chemotherapy, and radiation, experiencing many side effects and coma. But she never lost her spirit, and she recovered to participate in swimming, skiing, and other athletic events. Later, she recovered from a series of strokes. She said, after she lost her sight, "I have touched the edge of death many times and have seen the white light, experienced the peaceful miracle, a powerful yet gentle spirit who someday will lead us through transition and deliver us from despair. I have an inkling that we can take with us the greatest treasure that we can accumulate in this life. Love and hope. Yes, there is a bridge between the two worlds. She reminds me of a patient who left a note for me before she died, saying, 'Thanks for all the love.
I can take it with me. A chaplain asked, I am uncomfortable when the term failing is applied to patients who are approaching death. I believe death is one of God's and nature's forms of healing. Any suggestions for an alternative term? I also believe that death is a spiritual healing. I agree with him that we need to deal with this issue. It isn't that we need to come up with another term. We have a term. It's called death. Somebody died. Let's talk about it. Not, they bought the farm, kicked the bucket, passed away, went to a better place, and on and on. Let's talk about it so we can confront these things. These terms are used in hospitals. I hear them all the time. At Yale, people talk about Bradying because the morgue is in the Brady building. When a friend of mine died in the intensive care unit and I asked the next morning what had happened to him, the secretary said he Bradied. I could not get her to say that he had died. But we can see death as a form of healing. Let us say to each other, if you're tired and sore and need to go, it's okay. Your love will stay with us. My mother gave my father permission to go, to leave his body. We had gotten a hospital bed for him to have in the house. And one day my mother called to tell me, Dad is saying, I need to get out of here, Rose. She interpreted that to mean that he didn't like the hospital bed. But I said, Mom, it's his body he needs to get out of, not the bed. And she understood. He didn't fail us. He left, surrounded by his loved ones, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And every single person that he loved who could get there was there. He waited for all of us. He took his last breath and left when the last person walked into the room, and something beautiful was accomplished. If we can understand that death isn't a failure, then we'll feel comfortable in using the word dying. I see this in the drawings people make. When the color purple, which has a spiritual significance, is used, such as with a purple balloon or kite or butterfly moving out of the picture, I interpret this as the artist saying, I'm ready to leave. As a matter of fact, the Greek word for soul also means butterfly. To me, the person is saying, my body is not a place I want to be in anymore. It doesn't mean you wouldn't like to live 100 years if you were well. But you say, I'm ready to go, so let me go. And then leaving the body is a spiritual transition and is your next form of healing. You're whole again. I always remember a lady who had an arm amputated as treatment for cancer 40 years earlier. But now, she drew a picture of herself with two arms. Now, if you hadn't had an arm for 40 years, how do you put it back on again? Well, the drawing told me that she was ready to die and that she was feeling totally whole again. When you die, in a sense, all the parts are back. You're whole again. These people haven't failed. They have healed. We have to understand we are recycling all the time. The flower dies. It becomes compost and becomes a flower again. And I believe that's what we are doing also. I received a letter from a woman saying, I have lived and loved every day, and the life I have right at this moment is a gift. I am tired and sore. I am ready for the next stage of my journey. I wanted to share with you a very simple but beautiful truth I have written in my healing journal, one I have shared with my family and friends. This is the gift I carry now in my heart as I begin to sing a new song. To know that I am not a disease or the ugliness of the disease, but to know that my spirit and light heal and radiate a light that is beyond all knowing and beauty, and it is that beauty I am. It is my spirit that will live for all time, and it is that enduring part of me that I carry to eternity and will celebrate in the presence of my God. I wouldn't have missed it for the world. A young man who was a medical student and who was suffering from cancer wrote wonderful letters to his friends. One of these was included in his memorial service. He said, Your support keeps my spirits up. Thank you. I feel that I must tell you that even if I do not achieve my dreams in the form that I dream them, I know that it is not because God has failed me. It is not because my family failed me. It is not because my friends failed me. It is not because my doctors failed me. And it is not because I failed me. It may be that my body failed me. His mother said, he lived all of his life. He died hugging a nurse and lived all of the way. We are so proud of him. At a workshop, a participant asked, I'm not so much afraid of dying as of dying by inches. How does one get control and stay in control and get rid of the fears? My answer is that instead of thinking in terms of control, think about peace of mind. When we try to be in control, that's when the artificiality comes. When people are hurting but smile anyway, saying, I'm okay, nobody will know I'm out of control. One man used to say, my disease is an inconvenience. He put on such a performance, it was killing him. None of the neighbors knew how sick he was. He would collapse every time he walked into his living room, and then have to be carried to bed. He'd stay there all night, pull himself together, and go out the next morning. He wasn't in control. He was denying and performing. If you want to be in control, confront your fears, like the fear of dying by inches. What does this mean? Perhaps we die in a sense by inches when we have conflicts. Resolve the conflicts. Dying by inches may get you to understand your value and worth. How many inches still make life worth living? Do you die if you can't work or walk? Is life worthwhile if you can see your family and beloved 1 hour a day? I've had men in the office saying, I can't work, what's the point of living? And I have to point out they have a wife and 2 children. These are questions you are capable of answering, and you can decide if there aren't enough inches or minutes left to appreciate life. Understand that if you're ready to die, it's okay. If that is your choice, and you're ready to leave your body, you can die at home, surrounded by loved ones, and not fail anyone. I know children who have said, Mom, it's your birthday today. I'm dying today as a gift to you to free you from all these troubles. A young lady who joined one of our groups, a social worker named Marilyn Rivas, came to our workshops. She had sponsored several talks that I gave in Rhode Island. She told me she was going to Florida to die amongst her friends. When she got there, one of her friends was working with autistic children and dolphins and got her into the water with the dolphins. Their love and affection and gentleness changed her and prolonged her life. She felt beauty and peace in the relationship with them. She learned so much from them. Remember, nature is our teacher. Several years later, when she was tired and ready to go, she came home to Connecticut. She called me one night, said she was having trouble dying. I said, that's funny, Marilyn. I've never had a phone call from a dolphin. The next morning, her parents called and thanked me because she had died quietly and peacefully that night. So be a dolphin, if you will. Get back to your instincts. Remember that path. Let go of the reins. Get back in touch with the part of you that knows how to live and how to die. Don't let society take over. Don't let others tell you what is right or wrong for you. Live your life and you won't die by inches. When you get ready to die, you will die. All those mechanisms that you have turned on to help you live can be turned off. You can be in charge. I see that in our ECAP groups, over 90% of the people in the groups who have died have never needed a hospice facility. Why not? Well, what is a hospice for? To resolve life situations and difficulties, to deal with physical and emotional problems, and help you in your dying process. Hospice plays a very worthy and important role. But if you've lived fully, the dying isn't a problem. And so our group members who have lived fully have shared all of that. And when they get ready to die, they die. Now, it may be a day, it may be a week later, because they may be waiting for somebody to come and visit. But it isn't a process of inches, it's one of completion. They live until they die. Another woman asked me, how does one embrace death in a positive way when it seems the ultimate loss of control? Death isn't loss of control by my definition. We are living with the gift of life, a gift we are trying to use to its greatest potential. We're not ever in control of anything, except maybe our own thoughts. It doesn't mean that we are not responsible and that we don't live fully, but being in control is an illusion. Only our thoughts are ours to control. As the nurse who worked in labor, delivery, and hospice said, death is a transition like birth. Some of us are trying to avoid change or transition, but it's inevitable. Aging is inevitable. I'd say confront it and use it. If you get back to living in the moment, what age are you? What is the best day of your life? My answer, today. You're ageless today. You are enjoying the moment. Most of us won't accept that. Now I know that as I get older. I can't run as fast or as far as I did years ago, but I can still participate and enjoy an activity as if I were still a child. So in a sense, the peace that comes with the activity, with the meaningfulness of the day, stops you from focusing on death. I have run 3 marathons in my life and trained for 4. The second time I overtrained and hurt myself and couldn't participate. I learned a lesson. But in 1991, the third time I ran, I trained more sensibly. I ran with our daughter-in-law, Judy, who is a young physician, and our son, Jonathan, an attorney. Judy knew that one of the reasons I was running again was to hear the woman who shouts, "You're all winners." She was there again that year. Judy heard her too, and that helped make my day. I have said that God gives us signs when we are on the right path. In William Saroyan's The Human Comedy, please read it and just think of the title and what that says about life. There is a scene in which 2 brothers are walking down the street. One tugs the other and points, and there is a Lincoln penny face up. "A penny," Homer said. "Pick it up, Ulysses. It's good luck. Keep it always." And Ulysses picked up the penny and looked around at everybody, smiling at his good luck. When I was about to begin the first marathon, with 26 miles lying ahead of me, I felt I needed a sign that I was on the right path, and I found a quarter beneath my feet on the starting line, standing with 25,000 other people. And I found a penny many miles later. So this last time, I looked again for a sign. I wondered if I'd find my 26 cents. And I don't, frankly, mind sharing my craziness with all of you. I'm not afraid to. Lo and behold, in the grass, standing with 25,000 people again, I found a penny. I thought there was very little chance now of finding a quarter in the streets of New York. But many miles later, lying there in front of us as we ran the marathon course, was a quarter. I like to think of this, too, as a sign that I was on my path and that God was having a little fun with me. I'm proud to say that 21,000 people finished the race before I did. I'm proud because I realized it was the participating and the joy of the 3 of us coming to the finish line together that meant the most. Fred LeBeau, the organizer of the race, said that he admires most the people who take 5 hours to finish, because for them it is so much harder. Everyone got a medal, and I'm proud of mine. The 4th time I ran, to celebrate my 60th birthday, Fred LeBeau, who had brain cancer 3 years ago, also ran and motivated people to run to raise money for cancer care and research. The passion comes on us when we are afflicted. Fred LeBeau received over 2,000 letters congratulating him for running after having treatment for cancer. This last time I ran alone to be with myself. John and Judy finished before I did. I finished number 22,530th. But only 545 people my age ran. In my age group, I was in the middle. Once again, I learned that we are all winners. And I would ask all of you to keep participating in life. What I know about embracing death is that my own time will come. It will be sad for me to say goodbye to my family, to life, to the flowers. As I look around me right now, I am surrounded by beauty, by the sky and creation. I don't want to leave, but at some point, if I cannot be part of this beauty, if my body isn't functioning anymore, if I am the flower or the leaf that's ready to fall, it will be time. And so I will embrace the next step, the next healing, which will be to go. I think there is more to us, and that we do exist in some form when the body ends. I think it is damn exciting that we move on and go ahead to a new adventure. So I embrace the adventure of death, as well as feel saddened by it, and I hope that I can do it in as beautiful a manner as some of my loved ones and group members have done it. I want to be able to take it as a challenge. When I train and run a marathon, I confront myself and my body. I want to see death in the same way, to confront and face it. By the time I die, I hope I have stopped being afraid of everything, including death. If I have achieved that, then I will be ready. If there are things I haven't completed, yes, I'll be upset. Maybe a painting I want to do, someone I want to talk to. It's possible I can run out of time, knowing what I'm like, but I'm going to work like hell to get it all in, so that when death comes knocking, I can say, "Hello, friend, I'm sore. Take me in your arms, embrace me. I am ready to go with you." The strange thing for me is that when I taught a class at a local college, during the first session, I asked all the students to fill out their death certificates. It was incredible to see how these young people were writing on their death certificates that they were going to die in their 30s, 40s, or 50s of all kinds of tragic events. I had on my own death certificate that I would die at age 98. I would be having a birthday party, and I would climb up on a ladder to do some work on the roof of the house, and the family would all be there because it was my birthday, and they'd be yelling at me that I shouldn't be up there doing what I was doing at my age, and I would fall from the ladder and die. Recently, I had reason to think back to what I had written on my death certificate for that class. I think I know myself too well, and I'd better learn to change some of my habits. On the 4th of July, we had a picnic at our son Jeffrey's house, and when we returned home, Bobby went in to take a nap. I set up an old wooden ladder against the house. It looked in fine condition. I climbed up on the roof to cut off a limb. I was carrying an extension saw in my hand. As I got back onto the ladder and took the first step, the rung snapped. Apparently, part of it had rotted, and putting my support on that end snapped it, and I fell 14 or 16 feet. I don't remember the fall. I can tell you that my life didn't flash in front of me, and it wasn't spiritual. I just said, "Oh, damn." And down I went. I must have managed to hold on to the ladder so my feet and back hit first, and the next thing I remember was my head hitting the blacktop in our driveway. I was woozy and sustained a concussion and just lay there for several minutes. But the thing I realized again was, of course, that life is very uncertain. Had one of my feet gotten caught in the rung, and had I gone down head first instead of feet first, I might not be here making this tape. So I think we all need to learn that life is uncertain and to live it fully. I remember, too, a different experience with the closeness of death. When I was 4 years old, I was sitting on my bed, homesick with an ear infection. I had taken apart a toy telephone. Obviously, it wasn't a very safe toy. I put the parts in my mouth because I knew carpenters and workmen did those things, the big men. That's how they worked. So I filled my mouth with parts of the toy and aspirated them, and I was choking to death. I felt totally peaceful. I can still recall that feeling as I was sitting there on my bed. I knew that dying was not a problem. Even as a 4-year-old, I had a very spiritual sense of that moment. It's all so clear in my mind. But I was upset because I knew that my mother, who I could see in the kitchen through the open doorway, but couldn't call or make a sound to get help, would come in, find me dead, and say, "What a terrible child, he died." That's how I felt, like I was being a bad boy dying. A good child didn't do that. Isn't guilt wonderful? And then suddenly I vomited, and all those parts came flying out, and I could breathe again. I had a very strong sense that someone had made a decision that I wasn't to die at that moment. Perhaps the same energy or force or God that saved me when I fell off the ladder. In any case, I can tell you that our son Jeffrey has bought me a new ladder, much better than the old one. It can't rust, rot, or conduct electricity, and it will probably outlast me. There are all kinds of signs in dreams, poems, and drawings that people have precognitions of death. I remember one that appeared in our local newspaper. It had been written by one of the people who died when an airline jet lost a cargo door. The poem, which was written weeks before the flight, was about being sucked out into a vacuum and sinking into the sea. When you read this, you say, wow, he knew. Accidents happen, but sometimes we choose when we die. In every culture, more people die after birthdays and holidays. When we have something to look forward to, we can hang on or postpone death. There is a will within us and a fight to be a part of meaningful events. I hear people say, I'm going to die at 2 o'clock when the kids arrive from California. And this is indeed what happens. People have had dreams about things like getting on an airplane or dying on a certain day or in an operating room. And these things have happened often enough so that I know we have an intuitive sense. If you get a message of that sort, don't get on the plane, don't have surgery on a certain day, if dying on the operating table on Thursday was something you dreamt. Once I received a letter from a man who had written, dying on schedule, on the envelope. I don't know that anyone really dies based on an external schedule, but rather on their personal schedule of life. A nurse wrote to me from France and told me about a 30-year-old man with extensive cancer who wanted to see his daughter's first Holy Communion. The big day arrived, and his daughter came to see him in her communion dress. I shall never forget how happy he was, in spite of his condition. On the following day, he died, having achieved his goal. If you achieve your goals, then dying is part of your schedule. You are a winner. It doesn't mean that we want to be dead, but there is a point at which leaving our bodies is the next form of therapy. One woman told me that her father had cancer, but that no one would face this. After she read my book, she brought everybody together, shared her love, and let her father know that by dying, he was not leaving them. They cried, hugged, kissed, and loved for the remainder of his days. Her father felt at peace. He began having out-of-the-body experiences. She wrote, he prepared his living will and funeral arrangements. He even asked what he'd be wearing at the funeral. He suggested his green golf sport jacket and wanted us to make sure he was wearing his Nike sneakers because they were his best pals during his last months of ambulation. During his last week, he felt that he was traveling through a long tunnel with a bright light at the end with beautiful colors. This was fascinating to me because my father was never one to express himself in those ways. Another woman shared what her son had written before he died. She said that at his funeral, the sermon was given by a minister who hadn't known her son. If he had known him, she told me, he would have been aware that he always remembered his thank yous when he was halfway out the door. The minister read what my boy had written about how God gives each soul a new life. And how God looked up and saw a soul in front of him and said, it's a short life, only 14 years, but they're good years. And the soul said, that's all right. That's okay. I'll take it. And with a leap and a bound, he was off scampering down the hill towards the gates. And as quickly as he started, he slid to a stop and turned back to God, whose eyes had never left him. And thank you, he shouted. Thank you. A woman said of her father, his disease kept progressing, but I felt he stayed alive an additional 4 months because there were special days he wanted to participate in. His grandson's birthday, my birthday, and my husband's, and my 30th wedding anniversary. We had a lovely anniversary with a big dinner, champagne, toast, and cake, and all served lovingly by my sister. He ate and looked good, and after that he took to his bed, never to get up again. He experienced what he called severe pain 5 days before his death. In those days, he wondered why he did not die, except that the angels had not appeared to him yet. We decided together that the reason the Lord had not taken him yet was that the Lord was preparing us to accept his absence from us and for us to release him to the Lord. That Thursday, he rallied, talked all day, had unusual strength for his condition, shared his love with us and his Lord openly. He had never been an outward person, yet we knew he held these convictions in his heart. This allowed him the opportunity to share with us through hugs and tears. That night, two angels did appear to him at the bottom of his bed. He told us he would not be here tomorrow, and he died at 11:25 a.m. the next day. His lack of pain relates, I'm sure, to the lack of conflict and the peace that everyone involved felt. Tell me, can putting a bag over your head or breathing carbon monoxide do that for a family? At a conference recently, I was asked, what do you think of euthanasia? I somehow do not ever feel that active suicide is appropriate. When the body is tired and doesn't function anymore, then I think it is appropriate to go, to stop nourishing that body and let it die. That is different from putting a gun to your head. I think that suicide can leave an entire family with the message that in the face of adversity, one quits. When you die naturally, you leave something of yourself behind. Committing suicide leaves an emptiness and does not teach others about life and living. I don't like to see people commit suicide because of what they are afraid of. I'm not against helping people die in the sense that if they have said, I'm sore, I'm tired, I'm ready to go, we help them by not having the family or the nurses yell, finish your lunch. Or we have helped them be sedated so that there was no pain, so they could just relax and let go. In that sense, I have helped people to die. I've helped them release their guilt and not feel like a failure. I think if choices and power were given back to people, then we would stop worrying about the need to commit suicide because we're afraid we will develop Alzheimer's disease or be in pain. Don't be afraid of the future. That is really the message. When you get ready, let everybody know. Remember, when the men in Ireland went on hunger strikes and were not eating or drinking, it took them about 23 days to die. Well, if you stop eating and drinking and can be dead in 23 days, what are you afraid of? What could happen? What could happen is people would come in, put a tube down your throat, and feed you, and not let you die. Well then, make out a living will. Let everybody know what you want, and then you don't have to commit suicide. You can just stop living and let the process complete itself. This is part of the problem for many people. When we see a book on how to commit suicide become a bestseller, we have to realize that people feel they have lost their power. They are so worried about living that they are afraid they will not be in control of their dying. I am also asked about the other side of the coin. Under what conditions should doctors take extraordinary measures to sustain life? If you think about it, a heart transplant can be considered an extraordinary measure. We began this century saying, God save us from diphtheria. We're finishing it saying, God get me a heart transplant donor. What is an extraordinary measure? I'd say that has a lot to do with the individual. If I still feel that I'm capable of loving and contributing to the world, yes, I'd like people to take extraordinary measures to keep me alive. I know of a case in which a judge refused to allow a lady in coma to die when her husband and doctor requested it. That lady is well and functioning normally today. I think it is appropriate to take those measures to keep people alive. On the other hand, if I'm tired and sore, then an intravenous feeding might be an extraordinary measure, and I can say I don't want it. So the label, extraordinary, has to do with the stage the individual has reached in his life. There are things I, as a doctor, might not do for somebody who is 90 years old that I might do very easily for somebody who is 10. But I've also tried to resuscitate a 90-year-old because I knew that he was ready to keep fighting for his life. The American Association of Retired Persons mentions that the treatment of cancer in the elderly is different from that in younger people, that perhaps older people are not treated appropriately. I think that has a lot to do with the individual, what labor pains he is willing to go through at what age. It's not just a matter of blaming the medical profession for not treating people adequately. Perhaps the doctors are thinking of them as people and are being somewhat less aggressive because the treatment might be worse than the disease. It would be best if each of us made a list of what we call extraordinary and allowed our families and physicians to see it, whether that means assisted respiration, transplants, intravenous feeding, or a host of other things. We can at least give people an idea of what our philosophy is and what we would consider important to living, so that one individual who is brought back may say, why did you do this? I want to be dead. And another who has lost limbs or is paralyzed may still be contributing to the world and will be happy to be alive. Remember, the love stays with us. It was Gandhi who stated that grief over the loss of a loved one was perhaps our greatest delusion. for we retain within us the essential character of that relationship. That it is only form, not substance, which is lost, is something most of us can only appreciate as a consequence of the experience and grief, not instead of grieving. I have seen in our group meetings that the week after someone dies who has really lived, has taken on challenges, dealt with afflictions, the meeting contains a warmth and a wholeness and a fullness in the room even after that person is gone. And when this hasn't happened, there is an emptiness. We cannot complete the life of someone who is gone, who has not lived. Michael Lidington, a young man who died of cancer, wrote a poem which he asked his brother Ryan to deliver as his final message at his funeral. The poem is titled Dare. I must add that initially Michael had written a poem called I Won when his cancer went away, and I was critical of the title of the poem because I told him he was a winner whether the cancer went away or not. And then it did come back, and Michael died of cancer, and this poem was read at his funeral from a 14-year-old. Was not there a time when a man could be a man, when a woman could be a woman, and neither one could live without the world? I see a world with disaster foretold. I live in a fantasy from times of old. People don't care for silks or gold. No one's evil. No one's on parole. I came into this strange world not knowing up from down. It's a world of independence where people need to love. Do what I have done and challenge the world. Take nothing for granted and know where you're going. Let go of all your physical restraints. Don't rely on anything. This material world won't make it without the love of God. Many people care for you, or else they wouldn't be here for you. Trust me, anything is better than no one. Wipe your tears. I'm having fun. Do what I did and accept the worst challenge of your life. You see, I beat the challenge. I won. Soon I'll be in a better place of no hate or disease. I'm always with you, so I don't want to see one tear on your face. You can beat the world, so challenge it. I dare you. Michael died peacefully at home. After the songs, poems, and eulogy, as his mother said, Michael had the last word. An art therapist on the West Coast has started a program at a hospice in her area. She says, in traditional cultures, people went to the medicine person not only for themselves, but to restore harmony to their family and community. When you look at illness in that light, healing many times takes place even though the patient dies. This is something that I have seen over and over again. A fullness can be left behind. Entire families can be healed by the death of an individual because of what they produced in a spiritual sense as well as sometimes in a physical sense. If you want to live forever, love someone. Now, I'd like to share some stories with you that have been significant for me in trying to understand what life is about, what we are here for. One story is about my father who died recently. When he died, on June 23, 1991, I learned that we are capable of accomplishing all the things we have been talking about. As I mentioned before, he died at 3 p.m. on Sunday afternoon with a smile on his lips, surrounded by all of the people who loved him who could be there. On Sunday morning, when we arrived at his bedside, I asked my mother to tell me the full story of how they had met, of what had brought these two people together to create this family. And she began to share the humorous account. While she was on vacation in Coney Island, New York, with her family, she was sitting on the beach with some girls she didn't know. She said, later I learned they had a poor reputation. My father, also on vacation with his family, came down the beach with some teenage boys. They tossed a coin to see who would get the other girls. And as my mother said, your father lost and got me. Well, that began our laughter. I watched my father's color improve with more stories and a smile appear on his lips. I had the feeling that at any moment he might open his eyes and say, I've changed my mind. I have decided not to die today. This is just too much fun. But finally, our daughter Carolyn arrived. She She was the last person who could make it to his bedside, other grandchildren being in various parts of the country. My father didn't know this consciously since he was in a coma, but I believe that at a deeper level he was aware of who was coming. Bobby said, "Carolyn's here," and at that moment, my father took his last breath and died. This was an incredible gift to all of us, particularly to his children and grandchildren, who now have no reason to fear death. One of our children asked me if this is what death was like. I said, "It's what it should be like, but unfortunately, generally, it is not." And so, I would ask you to think about how you too can die with a smile. There's a simple answer. You're surrounded by your family and friends, and you turn to them and say, "Tell stories about our lives." Now, if there's a dead silence, you are in big trouble. And so I am forewarning you to do now some of those wonderful childlike things that everyone will remember and treasure. The way I put it is, please embarrass your family. Of course, the key to this and the key to living between office visits is to live in the moment, not between anything, not in any limited sense, but right now. Why I call this embarrassing your family is because your childlike quality comes out and your children are embarrassed to be seen with a father who acts childlike. How will you know when you have achieved what I am asking you to achieve? Once a month, invite your family out to dinner. And one night, when all of your children say to you, "No, you go out, we'll stay and eat what's in the refrigerator," you know that you have reached the stage that I want you to be at. Your children no longer want to go out with you because when the waiter comes to the table and says, "How may I help you?" you say, "I have been in therapy for years, I'm on medications, what can you offer?" Those memories of my father helped me to let go of my grief. Something else helped too. A woman attended a workshop I was giving and at the end gave me a present, a book called Poems That Touch the Heart, compiled by A.L. Alexander. One day, about a week after my father's death, I was feeling the pain, the grief, the loss, and I picked this book up and flipped it open, much as I often do the Bible. A story appeared before me called The Dark Candle by Strickland Gilliland. The story is about a man who is incapable of functioning because his daughter has died. He just can't bring himself to do anything. One day he goes to sleep and dreams that he is in heaven, where all of the children are marching by with lighted candles. He sees one child way down the line with a dark candle. So he runs to that child, and as he approaches, he realizes it's his daughter. And he gets to her and says, "How is it, darling, that your candle alone is unlighted?" And she says, "Father, they often relight it, but your tears always put it out." That helped me unburden and go on living. What are we hearing from all this? That if you live your life properly, and I hope I have explained what properly means, then you have given to the world and can die joyfully. And your loved ones will remember to keep living and rejoicing also in remembrance of you. That does not mean there isn't grief, but there will be a joy in your heart knowing that you have made a difference. So think about what you can do so that you will die with joy in your heart, knowing that you have lived fully and that you have done all that you were meant to do. What am I asking you to do? I'm asking you to start being and stop playing a part. Don't act, but be. Develop your healing partnerships with physicians, mates, lovers, friends, so that the marriages, the partnerships, the relationships become healing relationships in which something greater is created, and so that we no longer have to hide ourselves and bury our feelings. I know that you can continue to heal yourself and to give birth to yourself. Labor can be difficult, but if someone is with you when you are in labor, it becomes much less painful. That's a scientific fact. You respond to that love and that caring and that support. In your journey, understand that God is present. If you are uncomfortable with the word God, then just substitute love. Because when you love, God is a part of your life, invited or not. I want to share one last story with you. My father-in-law died January 26, 1993. He was 97. Many years before, he had fallen, injured his spinal cord, and was paraplegic. How would it feel being in that prison at age 97? I asked him, before he died, to give me some advice when I was going to a conference on aging. What did he want people who were growing old to know? His comment was, tell them to just fall on something soft. When I came back a few days later, he said, I have to revise that. I said, why? He said, well, I fell on my wife and I broke her leg, so that's no solution. And a few days later, I came in. He said, I know the answer. Tell them to just fall up. When he told me that, I laughed, but it has occurred to me since how much he was really saying. I think my father and my father-in-law have just fallen up. Thank you.